Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
Greetings and welcome to today's meeting, Commonwealth Club of California. I am Bill Grant, co-chair of the club's Health and Medicine Member-Led Forum and chair of this program. It is my pleasure to introduce Bob Kotcher and Lenny Mendoza. Bob Kotcher, MD, is a partner at Venrock and focuses on health IT and services investments. He currently serves on the boards of Devoted Health, Vitra Health, Allidade, Lyra Health, where he is co-founder, and Primera. Additionally, he is an adjunct professor at Stanford University School of Medicine, senior fellow and advisory board member at the Leonard D. Schaefer Center for Health Policy and Economics at USC, and guest scholar at the Brookings Institute. He serves on advisory boards of Harvard Medical School. Lenny Mendoza is a director emeritus, retired senior partner from the Washington, D.C. and San Francisco offices of McKinsey & Company, a global management consulting firm. He is a senior fellow at the Presidio Institute. Lenny founded McKinsey's U.S. state and local public service practice. He is also a board member of the Commonwealth Club. So today, some of the topics they will be discussing are: healthcare is super important, it costs about as much as a new Toyota Corolla per family per year, we're having a hard time affording it today and in the future, demographics, super expensive drugs, and hospital monopolies are big problems. Lenny and Bob have a variety of vantage points on the challenges and what to do. Gentlemen.
Thanks, Bill. Thank you. So thank you, Bill, and thank you all for joining us here this evening for what I'm sure will be a very interesting and wide-ranging conversation about what's going on in our healthcare system in the United States and in California, and what's the outlook, and you know why you should all not buy that Toyota Corolla every year because you're going to have to spend it on healthcare. So,
or maybe we should buy the Toyota Corolla and spend less on healthcare.
Yeah, that's probably
better for
the economy. That's a better idea. So Bill gave an introduction to Bob that was a nice one and a formal recognition of Dr. Kotcher's professional accomplishments. And I just wanted to add to that that I've known Bob for over a decade now. We worked together when he was at McKinsey, and Bob led some of the first and, at least in my view, some of the best work trying to understand why U.S. healthcare costs so much when he was there. That's a public document and still something that a lot of people turn to say, trying to understand what drives the cost and performance of our healthcare system. It was so impressed that President Obama asked him to join the administration and be one of the principal architects, particularly on thinking through the economics and incentives of healthcare reform. And he came back to McKinsey for a little while and then decided, like everyone else, to move to the Bay Area because it's where all the innovation is. And so we're delighted to have Bob back in town. And when he made himself available to have this conversation, we jumped at it. So again, please give a warm welcome to my friend Bob Kotcher.
It's embarrassing when Lenny, who's my mentor, says things like that because he deserves the credit for actually giving us the good ideas. So thank you.
Well, so let's start with today. We'll get back to healthcare reform in the United States and how that happened. But so we have a new administration in Washington who seems to believe that the direction was not the right way to go in healthcare reform, and you know, we're that close, except for John McCain, to passing a repeal. So where are we, and what do you see going on?
So first, it's incredibly frustrating to have a new administration come in and say they would do it all differently without actually saying what they would do, because we probably wouldn't have chosen Mitt Romney's healthcare plan if it weren't actually the most logical, affordable, effective way to cover most Americans and hopefully make healthcare costs grow more slowly. We looked at many, many other ideas ranging from single payer to Medicare for all to Medicare Advantage for all to high deductible health plans for all, and there wasn't actually a solution we could find that actually achieved the goals of near universal coverage and costs that don't go more quickly. And so, you know, I scratch my head because when you say you want to repeal, you certainly don't mean that you don't want 50 million Americans to gain access to health care and many people in care not to get care. And so it was frustrating to sort of listen to the conversation. I thank God for John McCain, and I think that his thumbs down at 1:37 a.m. was largely a byproduct of his friendship with Senator Kennedy. They were dear friends and longtime colleagues and voted together on many, many issues. And I think John McCain had two thoughts in his mind when he did this, which was, first, that his last major vote, to have it be the thing that unravels the legacy of Senator Ted Kennedy, would be a really sad way to sort of mark your impact on America. And secondly, I believe that he realized that as a patient receiving chemotherapy at the Mayo Clinic, sitting next to patients who are getting chemotherapy on Medicaid for their cancers, that if he were to vote no, that those patients wouldn't be okay. They can't afford healthcare in America. Healthcare costs $6,000 a day. I mean, it's insane what it costs to be a patient. And if we took away coverage, health needs don't go away. They're not elastic. And I think John McCain was thinking about that. I think he was also thinking about the fact that his brain tumor was in exactly the same spot in the head as Ted Kennedy's brain tumor, of exactly the same tumor, and he will die of exactly the same thing. And I think those things caused him to say, wait a minute, like, if we repeal, we don't have a replacement. We have no other alternatives. And when you go behind the scenes and look at, like, the CBO scores of every other version of this, they're all markedly worse, which is why Republicans, when they were doing the iteration, if you recall, every version that they came up with covered 20 to 25 fewer million people and cost more. And so there's not like a better solution here. And so I thank God that they didn't make a tragic mistake early in their hubris and rush. It obviously took us much longer than we expected to pass the Affordable Care Act. We thought we'd be done by Memorial Day and like move on to a summer of jobs and infrastructure spending. It took us like a year and a half. Healthcare is actually complicated and the details matter. And there's a ton of nuance and implications to every change you make, and it requires thought. And so I'm thankful that we haven't made any rash changes. And as I sit here today, I would predict that by the end of the year, more Americans will have insurance than have ever had before. Ironically, there's a bunch of Republican governors who now have an imprimatur from a Republican administration to expand Medicaid, which is what every other sensible governor has already done, but do it now with a Republican twist, which might be one with some requirement or some modest cost sharing. But that will provide coverage to millions more people. And so I weirdly sit here saying that it will be ironic that the Trump administration, I suspect by the end, despite everything they say, will end up with more Americans covered predominantly on Medicaid than we achieved. Yeah, amen.
And some of those have happened on the ballot, or at least...
Yeah, over the objections of Republican governors.
Right. And so what, you know, the sense was this is an unpopular program. It's not working. We got to get rid of it. And then we put it to voters, and it, even in red states, is passing by 60%. So what
why?
Square those?
So I come at this from being a doctor. And so one of the most rewarding parts of my life is occasionally I have the privilege of caring for patients and actually sitting with them and being with them, helping to figure out what to do. And there's nothing more terrifying than being a patient in America. We treat you terribly. We charge you a lot. You don't have a lot of information. You're hoping I do the right things. You know you're going to get a mountain of confusing bills and paperwork. And the idea that we're going to make it cost more for people and get harder is something that's sort of impossible to imagine. And I think we all realize at some point we're going to use the healthcare system, and you want it to work well. You don't want to go bankrupt. You don't want to have an $8,000 deductible. You don't want to have a network that doesn't include the doctors that you wanted to go to with the system that you chose. You don't want to fragment your care. The medicines that we prescribe are expensive and they're necessary. They're not, it's not an option. Like, just don't take blood pressure medicine until you need it. Like, that's a really bad strategy. And so I think people realize that healthcare is a human right that we need to provide. And we don't have an economy in America that allows people to afford to self-insure. I mean, $6,000 hospital days is the average in America. I mean, some are more. When you come see me in my office, it will cost $250 for you to come see me. And that will be the most expensive thing most of my patients will do each month, you know, is to see me. And so, like, healthcare is not something you can afford to sort of do without insurance. We need it. And I think Republicans and Democrats understand that, you know, health is not an option. Like, we don't, we have genetics that determine, honestly, what's going to happen to you. And you can modify it a little bit. Like, you shouldn't smoke, you should sleep, you should exercise and, you know, eat nutritious food. And if you do all that, you still will get the diseases that you're going to get. And so I think people realize that, like, they can't change their demand. And it sure is regressive if you tell somebody who happens to be born with rheumatoid arthritis or irritable bowel syndrome or arthritis or migraine headaches for that matter, that they have to sort of every year have that extra cost. Like they can't stay for retirement. They can't do other things that we want people to do. And I think that leads to healthcare being more popular than sort of politicians at first appreciate. And when you give people the option of, by the way, we'll take away the subsidies you're getting today and you can buy a consumer plan, all those plans are actually like worse because they cost nearly the same. They cover fewer things. When you get rid of the essential health benefits, they're called essential because they're actually the benefits that you need. Like that's why they're there. And if you take away cancer care and maternity care and mental health care, like you might need them. And you need to have a pool of people who have them to make these things equitable and affordable. And so these plans that you buy cost about the same or more. They have much higher deductibles. They always have narrow networks. And then they might not cover the thing you need. And so that's never, like when you actually say, well, here's the alternative, like no logical person would say, like, that's what I want. I think that's why we're seeing this sort of pushback across the country towards repealing Medicaid and things. I mean, the Republicans, you know, most of them, don't want to get rid of essential health benefits because they are essential health benefits.
So while there's legislative change happening in some states and there's not a lot of congressional action, there are a lot of other things that are going on to alter the Affordable Care Act and the incentives and delivery of health care. Which ones of those that have happened since the election matter, and which ones are you keeping your eye on?
So honestly, nothing has mattered since the election on the ACA. Since McCain did this, all this other stuff that they're doing is what I would call an announceable. It's like sort of like claiming credit for something that didn't actually occur yet or won't actually happen. And so, yes, in the tax bill, one of the, I think, unfortunate provisions is that they repealed the individual mandate. And that sounds like a big deal at first, except for the fact that the mandate wasn't very large. Remember, we got a lot of criticism for having a mandate that was too wimpy to get people to buy insurance. What made people buy insurance is the enormous subsidy that you get to buy insurance. You know, insurance for a family of four is $18,000 a year. And so it's not like the mandate makes you spend $18,000. It's the subsidy that makes the insurance affordable that leads you to buy insurance. And that did not change. And so, thank God, that stayed. And the mandate went away. And we haven't seen a very big difference, you know, in insurance enrollment. And we're not expecting a very big difference in insurance enrollment because it's the subsidies that matter. That said, a mandate is a good idea, and I hope that states like California and others will put it back, because the more you can bring young, healthy people into a pool of people, the lower the average cost is, and it makes it cheaper for the government. So the CBO said getting rid of the mandate makes insurance premiums go up because sick people then buy, and since subsidies are based upon the cost of insurance, not anything else, it just makes the subsidies go up. And so it's a bad policy to get rid of it, and I think states that are wise will reinstate it. The other things that they've done actually are continue most of the things that we started. So the Affordable Care Act is, you know, ridiculed for being long. I would argue the margins are narrow. But there's a bunch of it in the middle that actually isn't about insurance. It's about actually trying to bend the cost curve down. And the most important part of the middle part is the central idea that we need to shift the payment model from paying doctors to do more activity to you to paying doctors to do more outcomes and kind of better total care. And in that middle section, there's 35 payment model pilots that we promulgated. And those are the things that actually are changing healthcare in America, I believe, for the better. I think having full coverage changes it for the better, but the actual delivery is through these payment model changes. And thank God, the only thing that the last Republican Congress did in a bipartisan way was pass a law called MACRA, which passed the Senate 92-8. So bipartisan, Republicans passed this. And this law took the middle section of the ACA and inculcated in another law called MACRA that won't be repealed or replaced, which gives requires Medicare by 2019 to move most of its payment models to not fee-for-service. And they're promulgating a whole bunch of them, things called accountable care organizations, things called bundled payments, partial capitation, full capitation, quality bonuses for specialists, all kinds of things. And while we don't know exactly which one works, and they probably all have different contexts and local market settings where they'll work, they're all, I believe, better than just paying me to do 45 patients a day as fast as I can. They all reward me to do as a doctor things that hopefully engage you in your care so that you're less likely to go back to the hospital with an unexpected readmission, that you're more likely to take your medicine, that I'm more likely to make sure you know what's our goal here. It's a cholesterol below 100 or a blood pressure at this level. And it rewards doctors for achieving those outcomes and for over time avoiding complications and making me richer if you don't have complications. And we have risk adjustment and things to incentivize me to care about all patients equitably. But that's the part that I get excited about. And the reason that's so exciting is that the great Atul Gawande, the New Yorker author that hopefully you've all read, if you haven't, read Being Mortal, he's awesome. he said, you know, we'd be screwed as a country if it was the case that the best healthcare in the country could only be delivered at Harvard and UCSF and Stanford, the most expensive hospitals by the most highly trained, expensive doctors with the most expensive drugs and technology. If that were the answer, we would, you know, we should give up or we won't have schools anymore. Like, it's all going to go to healthcare costs, right? Turns out that the best healthcare in America is delivered at much lower cost in the community with primary care doctors who can achieve much better outcomes at much, much lower cost. And we just have to get more of that. But that's been invented in thousands of instances around the country, in California and around the country. Better systems of care. Kaiser here is a larger implementation of something like that could be made even better. But we need to have systems that reward that. And all of those systems that deliver this better care at lower cost have in common that the doctors are not paid by activity. They're paid to keep you healthy. And the longer you have a patient in systems like that, the more you'll do to engage them in all the things upstream that keep them from getting sick. And we need a system that does that. And that's what these payment models do. And thank God that actually got lifted out of the ACA, passed another law, and it's being implemented by this administration without talking about it a whole lot. But it's leading to a lot of change in a good way in America. And we're seeing it in the data. Like, we've seen it, readmissions in America go down dramatically in hospitals. We've seen preventative care go up a bunch. We've seen Medicare Advantage plans achieve a lot better screening than we had before. Like, we've seen childhood obesity in the NHANES data actually, for the first time ever, get better. Like that's great. Like, we're 1.5 trillion calories were taken out of the food system by food reformulation by Walmart in the last 3 years. Like, we're seeing like things happen that wouldn't have happened, I believe, if there weren't payment model changes.
Interesting. It's not stuff you read about every day. So let me.
But you need to read different stuff. Like,
the collective we read about every day. So let me ask you to take one step back to explain why those things are so important. So why does healthcare in the United States cost so damn much?
Oh my gosh. Two reasons you can get. So one is there's too many people doing it. So healthcare, unfortunately, has been the largest sources of job growth in America since the recession. Healthcare is the only sector of the economy that every month since the Bureau of Labor Statistics has tracked jobs has added jobs. During the recession, when we shed 8 million jobs, healthcare added about 1 million. Healthcare also raised prices in the recession. Healthcare hired people before we expanded coverage, and they hired them after expanded coverage. Healthcare demand in hospitals has been relatively flat. And they've kept hiring all these people. And that's great because we need jobs in America, right? These jobs are middle-class jobs. The average wage is about $65,000. Like, they're good jobs, but they're very expensive. And so if you take the $3.3 trillion we spend on healthcare, two-thirds of that is actually just wages to workers in healthcare. And so, yes, we have all kinds of troubles figuring out how we're going to pay for drugs. They're expensive. Technology is expensive. But actually, it's labor productivity. Healthcare, education, and defense are the only sectors that basically have no labor productivity. We published a paper a couple of years ago in the New England Journal of Medicine where we looked at all the healthcare jobs and looked at productivity and concluded that it was negative annually. And the U.S. economy's main strength relative to the rest of the world is that we're more productive than other countries. So healthcare has this problem of hiring more people than demand. And we need to re-engineer that system. Now, it can be done. Like, every other part of the economy has figured out, like through capitalism, how to engineer out non-productive labor and have more productive labor and make this work better. So we can do it. But one is we have to have a much more efficient system from a labor perspective. That's one. The other way to look at it is we have to take care of the 5% of Americans who are really sick differently. So the other way to cut American healthcare is that the top 10% of sick people in America account for more than half of all the spending, okay? And so 90% of Americans, honestly, if we just told them to keep eating right and exercising and sleeping at night and not do anything, they have no bearing on our healthcare costs. It's the 10% who are really, really sick. And for those patients, unfortunately, we have a haphazard, uncoordinated, super expensive, information poor, awful system of care that sometimes does miraculous things, but most of the time does just really expensive things. And that has to be done differently. And there's ways to do that differently too. There's companies that have doctors that go, it's cheaper for those people to send me to your house. And so there are companies that have been thriving. They do house calls for these people because asking them to like get to me is like a whole day event with like an ambulance involved to get them to come see me. When you see the 22 medications that they're on, well, of course they don't feel great because these medicines interact and they make you sleepy. When you see how they live, you immediately find a whole bunch of things that you change to make them safer and better. When you see that they have, on average, according to Medicare, three Premica doctors, well, none of them are in charge. You need to have one person be in charge. They almost all would benefit from a social worker to help navigate the things that they're eligible for and streamline it. They often have like a corner full of medical devices that they don't need anymore that need to be taken back. Like, it's a mess. And so we can take care of those patients better. And again, what's awesome is Atul Gawande's talked about this, and is that there's heroes who, you know, they're called hotspotter doctors who go and do this. And like in every instance, you can find ways to make these patients do better, and you can avoid a bunch of hospitalizations. The big driver in this cohort is that they typically go to the hospital for about $80,000 of care a year, and then after the hospital, because they're so sick, they then go to a rehabilitation hospital and basically have another $80,000 of care a year. And you don't go to rehab if you don't go to the hospital, and you don't go to the hospital if you're well at home. And so there's a way to get upstream of this and do it better. And I think now the incentives are such that you can do it. One of the companies that I'm working closely with is building the system to do hospitalizations in the home. Because most of the stuff that you do in a hospital for medical admissions is basically lay in a bed for 12 hours. A nurse will walk in, and for 5 minutes she'll hang, or he will hang, a bag of medicine. It will run into your arm in 30 minutes, and we make sure you don't die. We do it again in 12 hours. Like, that is all we're doing. And so IV antibiotics and, you know, IV fluids and IV steroids, like, it's not that complicated. And so you can do it at home. And for these patients, it's much safer because they don't get infections. They eat their normal food. They're safe in their bed. They don't get delirious. Like, it's much, much safer. And so you have to handle the 10% differently too. And so I think about healthcare costs for me. How do I get labor productivity, and how do I change the care of the patients who are most sick?
Okay. And the reform that you said got passed by the Senate this time that ensures that there are more of these experimenting of alternative models. Are they actually working, or what are you excited about?
So there's a payment model called accountable care organizations. And the central premise of ACOs is Premica doctors, if we pay them more money, they will avoid a lot of downstream complications. And that's not like, that's like Marcus Welby. That is not a earth-shattering AI-informed idea. It's Premica works. And in America, in fee-for-service, we paid Premica doctors about one-third to one-half of what we pay a specialist. So not surprisingly, like, the specialist is like, give me all the patients, and the Premica doctors are like, I'm like underappreciated and overworked. So in this model, the Premica doctors can make often double what they made before, and they do a bunch more stuff, and they keep people from going to the hospital. And so that's the central premise of ACOs. There's now, I think, about 400 or so large ACOs in the country. Most of them have been in the program for 3 or 4 years. About $1 billion was saved last year by ACOs in America. Not surprisingly, the ones run by doctors save more money than the ones run by the hospital, because the hospitals have existential angst about paying the Premica doctors more to not use the hospital. So you can imagine that that's a tough CFO discussion to have. But you're seeing them work. You're seeing in Medicare Advantage, doctors who manage capitation earn much more by saving a bunch of money. And some of them now have planes because DaVita bought like Healthcare Partners here in California for $4.5 billion. And groups like ChinMed are expanding. And Iora just raised $150 million of venture capital. And so you're seeing Landmark raised $100 million. Like, you're seeing these take off. And so that's exciting to see.
Okay.
And you're seeing definitely money saved and quality improved.
Okay.
And patients like these things. Like the ChinMed, this group in Florida that's one of the most famous ones, they're in like 15 states. They have a net promoter score of 96. 96. Like, that crushes Apple. That's like super high. Health insurance companies have a net promoter score of like 5. I think the average is 13. Kaiser runs like 26. I mean, so like, patients like these things because the doctors listen and have longer visits and actually tell them how to avoid getting sick. And so, not surprisingly, like, it's a better patient experience. Patients like that.
So you'd mentioned Kaiser before, and you just mentioned them again. They're obviously an important player in California and across the country. How does their model fit into what you're talking about?
They do a lot really well. One of the things Kaiser figured out is when you're an insurance company and you're delivering the care, you do a lot of things differently. So Kaiser has hospitals, but they would not like you to use them. So that's a very different system than a normal insurance company. And what Kaiser's been great at is actually creating access. So the best way to have a patient not go to the hospital is have a doctor be able to see them when the patient needs to be seen. And so I'm very impressed by the fact that Kaiser in Northern California recently wrote a paper in New England Journal of Medicine saying that they will do more than half of all their visits this year electronically, either by video or by phone or by email. You know, at the places where I've been a doctor, we would tell the patients, if you wanted to email me to the portal, and I promise you within 3 days I will respond to the portal to your email that you can log into through this secure server with double authentication. I mean, it totally drives you crazy. So you just come see me, right? At Kaiser, they're like, every single patient can be seen today by not just a primary care doctor, but by a specialist. And not surprisingly, patients like that, and it leads to a lot of avoided cost. Another thing Kaiser does really well is when you leave the hospital, they're really good at making sure you have the medicines that you need to take when you get home. When you leave most hospitals, they hand you paper and tell you to go to CVS. But think about it. Like, when you leave the hospital, you feel terrible. I send you home 3 days later. You were just in the hospital. You feel awful. And so I say, here, go fill all these. It's really important. And so you might do that because you try hard and then you get them. But then you have medicines at home too. And then I say, I'll see you in a week. And that week is really dangerous because I often don't know everything you're on. There's a whole bunch of messed up stuff that happens in that. Kaiser figured that out. Another thing Kaiser does super well is I used to be a cancer doctor before I got sidetracked. And if I would tell you that you have cancer, your normal reaction if you were alive and a human was that you'd either be anxious or depressed. This is horrible news. And Kaiser has what's called coordinated care, where in every clinic they have a social worker and psychologist who's available to see patients when they need to be seen. And while there's lots of ways to make Kaiser work better, those are some things they do that are, relatively speaking, innovative, that we should adopt more widely because they actually improve health and lower cost. And then Kaiser's doctors, there's all kinds of complexity between the Permanente Medical Group and Kaiser, but because they're paid at least in a salaried way, they don't have this weird perverse incentive of I make more money on the dialysis joint venture and on the drugs I'm prescribing and on the MRI machine I own than on my day job. And so they don't have that little devil voice in their head that might lead them to act differently. And so I think there's a lot to learn from them. I think we can also learn about personalization, not from Kaiser. So Kaiser, in terms of improving them, one of the things that's super important is having multiple people, I think about patients' diagnoses and give second opinions and help get you to exactly the right optimal person to take care of you. And one of the flaws in America is that we're a very generalist-oriented health system. So I can get any patient and treat them for anything. And that's not great. There's a few things I do well and many things I'm not the best at. And having better ways to match patients to providers is something that Kaiser and all of us can do much, much better. We can do a lot better on helping patients know for them what matters. So we have a tendency to treat every disease in America with a medicine that we prescribe you. And most diseases, actually, you can watch carefully. And if I explain to you what to worry for, I could then initiate care when you need it, not sort of all the time, and give you a much simpler life of fewer medicines to take with fewer complications, and it'd be much easier to be a patient. We are terrible at adjusting medicine, so I'm great at starting medicines on you. So if you come to me after this talk, I will offer to prescribe you medicines probably, and then I'll never see you again. And so you will probably be on that starting dose forever, and that's sort of what we do in America. We are great at putting you on 10 milligrams of whatever, and then we never sort of ask, is it working? What should it be? And so we're bad at stopping them. And so those are things that I think we got to do better.
Okay. And what role does digitization, data, medical records, interoperability, all that stuff that worked so well in healthcare.gov,
mean the website wasn't perfect?
Yeah.
That was the worst internet launch of a product in the world. So listen, I apologize for healthcare.gov. I wish it worked better. Todd Park thankfully fixed it. It works quite well now. Cover California didn't, thankfully, always worked well. And Cover California has done a great job at reaching Californians and covering them and providing the best consumer experience actually in the country. And so we're blessed to be here, and Peter Lee is a hero. One of the first things we did is actually during the recession, we had the opportunity to pay doctors to buy and adopt electronic health records. And the reason to do that was a couple. One is you can't go from fee-for-service to other payment systems without having a way to track outcomes. Because the problem with every other payment system is when I pay doctors to keep you healthy, there could be a doctor somewhere that's unethical that decides just not to treat you and save money that way. And that's a terrible thing to think about. And I can't mitigate that risk unless there's some way for me to collect outcomes on patients. And if I have to have paper and fax machines as the way to do it, it's not. There's no way I would take the risk as a country to try to move us to a different payment model. So computers were a prerequisite to go from fee-for-service to anything else. You also have to adjust for patient risk. You have to do attribution. There's a whole bunch of things we needed computers to do. So one is we needed to have electronic health records to do that. Number two is there's a whole lot of things that get done again and again and again in healthcare. And so having a way to exchange information is super, super important.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
And it can now be done. Now, it's not always done, and that's not because the computers can't talk to each other. They can talk to each other just fine. The hitch is that the business models of the hospitals compete. And so for the same reason your bank can't transfer over your bill pay from one bank to the next, hospitals say that they can't transfer your information over because they don't want the patient to go away. So we have a business incentive problem, not an electronic health record problem, that we can't overcome. And I think actually this administration's been bolder than I expected on announcing that they're going to get hospitals to force them to do it, at least in some instances, in emergency rooms for certain types of patients, for the opioid crisis, to share information. Like we're actually going to force it to happen. I mean, it's ironic that a Republican administration will use administrative authority to do it, but I think they will. The third thing about EHRs is that in medical school, like we all memorized everything we could, and we could regurgitate back like a study and talk about like the trial. But I never could remember exactly what the patients were in the trial. I would just say, well, you have that problem, and I remember the trial. And so the computer is much, much better than I am at actually remembering the details of exactly what to do to you. And so the decision support that we'll have from being able to have Google and the internet attached to every doctor-patient encounter will improve health for people, absolutely. And electronic health records now are building tools on top of them, whether it's, I've seen a company that, has like an Alexa for doctors that you can say, like, remind me, what was, the study's criteria for this, or what's the dose of that, or pull up on the screen, like, the last 10 values of these patient lab records. You couldn't do that before. And so that is making healthcare quite a bit better. Now, doctors have complained vehemently in the process of improvement that they don't like typing, and I hear them. But I've also not yet seen a doctor who's gone back. And so as much as we all complain about Epic and Cerner and EHRs, you then say, well, do you want to go back to that paper? And they're like, well, no. I mean, I was just kind of kidding about that. And I think we all see the utility of information. I mean, information has changed every other experience we have as humans. It will make healthcare a lot more personalized and a lot safer and a lot more sophisticated in how we dose medication. So I think that we're at the beginning of 50 years of pioneering work on how to translate data and your genetics into what you need to do. I always have a hard time knowing which diseases that you have are going to progress. Data will really help us on that. My 9-year-old always asks me, Daddy, like, how long is my throat going to be sore? And I always say, like, 2 more days. And and there is data. You could draw histograms of people and be like, well, actually, it'll be like this many hours. Like, there's all these problems that data could help us answer that doctors today sort of make up. And so I'm very excited about like what we'll get.
Okay. And I promise not to ask you for investment advice, but you are investing in these kinds of things as well without necessarily naming specific companies. Are there things that you are excited about in innovation and technology that will really make a big difference in these?
Well, I just alluded to one. Artificial intelligence is going to change all of our lives in awesome ways and some non-awesome ways, I think, too. But in healthcare, my comment a moment ago, we don't really know which things matter, disease-wise. We know your genetic predilection. We know what I've diagnosed. I prescribe things. You and I think that some things may be working. We'll be a lot more sophisticated on tracking outcomes. Today, a lot of the times, my only data points are like every 3 months when I see you in my office, I like weigh you, measure you, feel your heart rate, and like write it down. You have all those heartbeats in between. That would be super interesting if there was a simple way to actually interpret it. Today, patients print out their data or bring in, a thumb drive of it, and it's difficult to know to deal with that. But we will have systems that will be able to ingest that and actually find signal in it that will make care much, much better. And so AI is going to be very important. I'm also very worried about safety of AI. So one of the nefarious things is in the AI data sets, what's amazing is you give the computer a giant pile of data, and you can tell it find relationships. It's effectively what AI is. And it will just do it all day long and all week long until it finds a bunch of stuff. But if the data is wrong, it will find things that are wrong. And I was recently working with some data scientists with data from a big teaching hospital, and they took all the patients with pneumonia and put it in to try to figure out optimal treatment for pneumonia. And the computer said that a bunch of things. But they said if you have asthma, that you're less likely to die of pneumonia. And we all know that that's absolutely wrong. What the data didn't have is the timing from when the patient arrived at the hospital to antibiotics. And every emergency room doctor knows in America, a patient who has asthma and a fever, you give them antibiotics before you get the chest x-ray. You do it right away. And when you do that, the thing that saves your life is the antibiotics early. They work. And if I come into the ER, or most of you come into the ER, they're going to like think it through and try to figure out, like, are you really have pneumonia, or is it heart failure, or is it something else? And so hours will go by. And so the AI doesn't know that. And so it comes out with an answer that if you were to just believe it, would lead to all kinds of bad things. And so there's first that error of, like, the data has a bunch of data that's missing in the data that's in the brain of the clinician. The second problem would be if you're an evil country or person, if you just change the data a bunch, that computer will lead you to an answer that's different. And in these data sets, they're so big, I would never find it. And so that's the other thing I worry about, is sort of nefarious changing of data. And you can imagine a whole bunch of, you know, like, evil things versus like a drug company, like just deleting the bad outcomes. Like, there's a whole bunch of things on that spectrum that worry me, because when data sets are really big, no person can actually check them. And so AI, I think a lot about that. I actually think that AI is not going to change what I do as a doctor as quickly as what it does to change the administrative jobs in healthcare. So when I mentioned the 2/3 of healthcare costs are labor and is wages to workers, of that, more than half of that is administrators. So it's not like we have a country that's just with an overabundance of doctors, nurses, social workers, and pharmacists and things. It's actually, we have a lot of coders, collectors, revenue cycle managers, quality improvement people, and blah, 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 credentialist. And a lot of that work can be automated and taken away. And if you change that, I can't hurt you. Like, if the AI gets the bill wrong, we can fix it, right? If the AI gets my cancer treatment wrong, like, that's a big, big problem. And so I believe that AI is actually going to get rid of a lot of the back office jobs first, and that will make healthcare cheaper and better. Hopefully it will eliminate fax machines, which is healthcare is the last place we use them. Hopefully they'll go away. Right now there's a half a FTE per bed in America just doing the coding and billing for the person in the bed, a half a person. Like, it's crazy. And so there are things that computers can do. It's $42 billion a year of labor costs, like right there. That a computer can do that we don't need people to do anymore. Like, there's a whole thing called, like, you know, credentialist, who basically makes sure that my medical school diploma is still true. I mean, like every 2 years they check it again. It's like it was.
You might have forged it. I don't know.
But we should have found it the first 17 times we checked it. Like, you know, and the state of California did too. And so there's all this sort of administrative waste where AI, I believe, will help us first. And that's where we're seeing it adopted in the rest of the economy. So AI is not making your latte at Starbucks. It's being used to, like, do coffee procurement. Like, it's that stuff. And so I think in healthcare it will do that. That's one. The second area that I'm most excited about is sick patients and trying to help them be better. And so I love the idea of investing in primary care groups that specialize in the sickest patients. I love the idea of specialists that take care of the sickest patients. I love the idea of hospital in the home, of home dialysis, of behavioral health. Behavioral health in America, it saves money. Like, you cannot possibly comply with your treatment regimen if you're depressed or anxious, and I don't treat your depression or anxiety. And so we need to make it not inaccessible. And if you try to access behavioral health to most insurance networks, you wait 8 weeks. Like, that's too long. And so I think about those interventions for people who are sick, because, again, we can't spend more, I believe. Like, our healthcare, we spend enough. We spend plenty per person to get the world's best healthcare. We have to figure out how to design the system of care differently to make it more affordable. And it's in that sick people population where I can have the greatest impact. And so that's where I'm thinking. Okay. That and non-clinical labor.
Okay, let's talk about a couple of those more complicated, actually treating people arenas, and where you see any opportunity to make it better and hopefully better outcomes as well as cheaper. What do you see or feel? You mentioned behavioral health, but mental health more broadly, it's a big area of need, and it feels like it's randomly cared for.
So behavioral health is it's like the least well understood thing, and I don't understand why it's been so complicated for our country. The first thing is the interventions that we have to treat behavioral health care work just as well as the pills I give you for every other form of health care. Like, if you have behavioral care disease, we can take care of you and make you have the same ability to live and do well as if you had most other diseases. And so the treatments work. And that's the first thing. People think, like, there's nothing we can do. No, no, no. We have treatments that work. These are chronic diseases. They are relapsing and remitting just like most other diseases. So it's, you know, you need to have access in an ongoing way and ways to monitor patients so you can intervene earlier. It's easier to help you before you're fully relapsed than not. And so you have to have access. Number two, I don't know why we tolerate less use of evidence-based medicine in behavioral health than we do in the rest of healthcare. So there are a bunch of people in insurance networks that practice non-evidence-based care, whether it's Freudian analytical psychology or hypnosis or pranic healing or eclectic therapy or play therapy. Like, they're allowed to practice. And I'm not allowed to practice, like, medicine in any way I choose. Like, there's standards of care. And for some reason, we've tolerated a standard of care in behavioral health to be much, much broader than we do for any other specialty of healthcare. And we need to fix that. We need to narrow it down. And then we have ways to track outcomes. Now, we are terrible at tracking outcomes across all forms of healthcare, but, like, you need to track outcomes here to know, like, what's working and what's getting better. And we are not very disciplined about doing it because the payment models haven't required people to do it. And I put a lot of the blame on the insurance companies here. So insurance companies have basically said, we'll take anybody in our network if you take a low enough price. And so in insurance networks, more than half the providers, when I checked one national insurance company's network of providers, advertised non-evidence-based approaches that they did. And so when I approached the insurance company, I said, why would you have a network where half the providers are like, don't do care that you would send your mom to and don't practice evidence-based care? Why would you do that? And they're like, had no good answer. And the main answer is, I think that they'll take the $70 that they'll pay per hour. And so if you're halfway decent at behavioral health care, in many cities, in many instances, you'll opt out. And so you go to a cash pay system outside of the insurance network. And if you're willing to pay the cash price, you can get access to evidence-based care quickly and you get better. And that's a disaster because it needs to be connected to the medical care because patients don't just have one problem, they have multiple problems. And like having this be coordinated under the same insurance arrangement, it makes a ton of sense. And you're seeing some employers now sort of say, like, we got to fix this. And so there's many employers in California working with a company that I helped found called Lyra Health that goes to employers and says, we give you access to all these people that don't take insurance that are actually that you want your people to go to. And not surprisingly, you can get access if you pay the fair price. And people get better faster. And it saves you money for your healthcare costs. It saves you money for your turnover for your workers. And you get productivity benefits. And so employers are beginning to see it. But we need to see this at a national scale sooner. In Medicare Advantage, similarly, for the sick people, you're seeing Medicare Advantage plans go and pay much more than commercial insurance plans for behavioral health, and sometimes even employ them. And like Kaiser does this as well, because they realize that it saves money. But for Medicaid and for commercial patients, we sort of have like not done that. And it's a terribly foolish, like penny-wise, pound-foolish approach to care. That can be changed. And this is it's like primary care. If you pay a little bit more for this, you get a lot of savings. It's like one of those, the ROI is very clear. And it's frustrating to me that we haven't scored the circle. In the ACA, we just created parity that health plans have to cover behavioral health. But we didn't sort of then say, and with an asterisk, like, and here's the criteria. Like we didn't define the network because like that was too paternalistic. But I'm surprised that we haven't seen it happen. And I think it's a competitive advantage. If I were an insurance company executive, I would actually differentiate myself by actually having a network where I paid more and got different people in it. So I'm not kind of selling exactly the same network as every other insurance company of kind of subpar quality.
Okay. Let's talk about another area that's a little sensitive and expensive and complicated, end of life care.
Yeah. Oh my goodness. I have a bunch of thoughts. The first thought is end of life. It is compassionate to make sure that we as a country encourage doctors to talk to patients about it. It's funny, like when I was in medical school, we always talked about for pregnancy, you wanted to talk to moms about having a birth plan. And we'd do all this work to make sure that there was a plan and then hopefully followed it. At the end of life, like we tried to pay doctors in Medicare to have an end-of-life discussion, and that was what led to the terrible death panel diatribes. It was simply to pay doctors to do a counseling session about what are your wishes and talk about medical power of attorney and advanced directives. Not that you had to do them, but just pay me to have the conversation. We need to do better at that. The worst place to die is in an ICU, in my opinion, as somebody who's been there. And so I'd much prefer to be at home. And in nearly every instance, it's safe and possible and humane and better to do it, and we can. I'm excited by the fact that there one company that we were not investors in, but I wish I were, called Aspira Health, was created up there in Nashville, and they spend the last they work with people in Medicare. And they typically meet them 4 or 5 years before they're going to pass away, and they do that advanced care planning because doctors haven't had the courage to have the conversations. These are social workers who go to your house and have the conversations, and not surprisingly, insurance companies found that it was super cost-effective to pay them to do this and then maintain a relationship so that when you actually need that social work, you have that person and that trust in that plan, and then they implement it, and people tended to die at home and have better deaths. That company recently was acquired for about $1 billion, and sort of at least as an example that you can build a business here that's working in end-of-life care. I think that as we move the payment system towards not fee-for-service, that creates a big incentive to have doctors begin to have these conversations because, honestly, it'll be economically advantageous not to have you spend $50,000 in that last month. Because remember, in Medicare, the typical premium you get per year is $10,000. So you get about $10,000 of money per senior on average in America. And so when a person's going to die and they're going to spend $50,000 in the last 2 weeks, that's devastation to a doctor who's capitated. And so hopefully that will reward them to have the conversations more often. But we've been really bad at, you know, every aspect of this. In medical school, we get like 10 minutes of training on end-of-life care counseling and empathy. And so there's a bunch of curriculum you can put into this to make it better. I think that you don't have to have doctors do it. Social workers do this better than doctors, as do PAs and MPs. Everybody seems to do it better than doctors.
Everybody does it better than surgeons.
You can... It doesn't. You don't need to have Google AI brains to figure out like when somebody's sick and you know when to have it. Like there's an article today I read it in the New York Times about Google can predict when you're going to die. Well, not that hard. If you look really sick and have an oxygen tank, like you're going to die. And so you don't need an AI computer robot to tell you. Like you can be like you're 90. Like we can talk to you. And so there's a lot of ways to do this without magic. And I wish we'd do more of it. You know, Zeke Emanuel and others have championed it, and hopefully we'll get to it.
Okay. So you talked a fair amount about it, and I've got a few questions here related to the role of insurance companies, and are we going to end up in a single-payer system? So what do you think?
Well, insurance companies sort of beg the question because payers exist in theory to, like, negotiate better healthcare costs, right? And they don't seem to do a great job because healthcare continues to get more expensive every year relative to your earnings. And so it's not clear to me, like, the market power they're bringing to bear here. They do know you know which doctors are more likely to be better for you, but they then don't tell you. And they robocall me at dinner to tell me that I need a flu shot. And so they don't do anything particularly well. And we pay about $300 billion for the choice to choose your insurance company. And if you can tell me the difference between Cigna, Aetna, United, and Blue Shield and Anthem, like I'd love to hear. Because the networks appear to be the same. And the experience is frustrating in all of them. And so I think the insurance companies have created a sort of a burning platform for them to suck less, to earn the right to take $300 billion out to sort of have that choice. So that's what it costs us. Like the cost of having choice is $300 billion of extra labor cost and profits to insurance companies. And I challenge insurance companies. I'm actually going to AHIP in 2 days to speak at their annual meeting. So you'll see how I'm received. My challenge to them is create value, like do something innovative, like pay the PCPs more, get behavioral health to be right, like tell me which doctor at Stanford's the centers of excellence for heart surgery and all the networks, because they have power with the insurance to say that they are. And there's four doctors, according to the California OSHPAD data, which is the state data, that do more than 80 bypass surgeries a year. Three of them are awesome, according to risk adjustment data, like they look great. One of them's not. Why doesn't the insurance company tell you? Like, why don't they put a blinking light? Like, when going to Stanford, these three choose, you know, like, why don't they tell you that? Why, you know, they know what bill should come and how much you should pay. Why don't they tell you? Like, why can't they do it once a month like anybody else? Like, and so there's all these things that seem like they're obvious, that if you're building a consumer product that you would have done like 20 years ago, and I don't know why they haven't changed faster. And they complain a lot about like regulations, but most of this is just their lack of creativity. And so whether or not a single payer is a good idea is there's a role in healthcare to try to help a patient navigate a complicated system and do it in an efficient way. And a payer could do that. Now, if they don't do that, I don't know why we need them. And so I think we have a question for, like, what value should they add? One of the problems that we have today with our multi-payer system is the fact that none of them can negotiate lower prices. And so I think part of the problem with the single payer idea gets at is sort of how do we get cost controlled? Because the private sector hasn't succeeded yet for a whole bunch of reasons. And it's unclear to me that the government will succeed unless the government's willing to actually negotiate prices or set prices. Because when you only have one drug to choose from, I can't really negotiate it because there's people who need it. And so we have to have, it's more than just single payer, I think, that bends the cost curve down. Another argument for a single payer is that, you know, you wouldn't have any gaming of the system because of everybody, you know, but there's a lot of nuance in how you design it. Like when people say a single payer, if you then say, well, what do you mean? Some say we give you a voucher to buy a private insurance company like Medicare Advantage for All. And that doesn't save any money. You end up with the same private payers negotiating, and it's just a different sort of funding mechanism. Some say single payer where the payer sets prices, and we let the private sector continue to do what it wants, but like set prices and sort of payment terms. Some are more like Kaiser, like where we nationalize like the doctors and the hospitals, and you know it's like the VA. So there's a whole bunch of spectrums, and it depends what you want for whether or not the idea makes sense. I believe it's hard to get, you know, we thought about it. There's a lot of change that occurs in that, and it's probably more than people are comfortable with having today. And it's hard to get the hospitals, doctors, insurance companies, and pharma companies that, you know, are important players to go along with it, because in any system that costs less with, you know, less competition, there's less profits for somebody. And so it's hard to sort of see how you get there from a policy perspective. But I think it begs a good question. You know, we wouldn't be asking for a single payer if we thought the payers we have were doing a great job. And so to me, the question is, how do we call that question and have them do a better job or cost a lot less?
So we often talk about the U.S. healthcare system like it's the only healthcare system in the world, but there are 200-ish different national healthcare industries, government roles, et cetera. Can we learn anything from someplace else in the world that you think is relevant for this conversation?
This is a question that's awfully tricky to answer, because Don Berwick, when he answered that question, made a good statement about another country's health system that couldn't get confirmed by the Senate. and so I will flip it back and say, in America, we have 50 different healthcare systems. We can learn a lot. And in California, we have like six. And so Peter Lee talks about, well, like, why is healthcare more expensive in Santa Cruz, California than LA? Like, it doesn't make any sense. It comes down to hospital market power and pricing. And so I think there's a lot we can learn from our system. Nobody's gotten it right. So one of the wonderful things I got to do at McKinsey is I worked in 22 countries with healthcare leaders around the world trying to figure out how to make this healthcare system on the earth work better. And none of them have gotten it right. So every hospital in the world is not as well run as, you know, most retail establishments that you go to every day. They all have doctors that show up late, that with lack standardization, where people, you know, don't use evidence the right way, where patients get uncoordinated care. They all have little nuances. Like in India, they have management engineers that are better at process integrity than we are. In Singapore, they do a great job at making the private hospitals compete against the public hospitals for the patients. And to tell the patients, like, everybody gets this level of care. You can pay more for private rooms and for different experience, but the same doctor. Switzerland has a thing where on their version of insurance exchanges, they've made it a narrower product, but then you all have to buy supplemental products to wrap around it, and so you get variation that way. I love in Sweden that patients do a lot of their own self-care. Nobody cares more about not getting an infection than a patient. And so patients do their own dialysis, they do their home IV antibiotics, and that's much more, it's much safer and better than what we do. In France, the primary care systems do a great job at population health. And so there's a bunch of things you can glean, but you can glean just as much from looking at what capitated providers do in Southern California versus Northern California as you can from going to Sweden.
Okay. So we are in a state that's the fifth or sixth largest economy in the country and has its own view that we ought to have our own model for healthcare. So we're going to have a new governor in November. He calls you up and says, what should I do? Bob, what's the answer?
Declare independence. I have a lot of ideas for our new governor. I think the sensible things are reinstate the mandate. It makes no sense that in California we don't have a mandate. It makes our insurance pool safer, better, cheaper. It's a good idea. We could do it as a state. If we're worried about premiums, there are things you can do. One of the ideas that made a lot of sense is we had what's called reinsurance. It's that 10% of patients that cost all the money. If you leave them in the pool that you're all buying insurance, then they make your premiums a lot more expensive. It's actually cost effective to pull them out and have the government pay for a larger portion or all of their premiums through a reinsurance pool. And then the average premium for everybody else comes down quite a bit. Alaska did that successfully and had a very low increase. In fact, they got a rebate last year in their individual market. We had reinsurance for the first 3 years of the ACA, and then it didn't get funded because Marco Rubio called it a bailout to insurance companies completely incorrectly. And so we could have reinsurance pools that would make our average premiums a lot lower in California, which would help that mandate work because people wouldn't be paying so much to get insurance. You could also change the age bands a little bit. And so right now, the ratio from young to old is 1-3. If you went to 1-4, the lowering of premiums for young people would lower the average premiums enough to make it actually not much for the old people. And so those are all things that you could do as a state that we should do. California does a great job with Cover California marketing, but we should keep funding that and having navigators help vulnerable populations get enrolled. And then there's harder things. So in California, we don't have a lot of competition on the hospital side. And one of the things that makes this healthcare in California so expensive is this requirement around network adequacy. And the law says that every Californian and every American needs to be within 30 minutes of every type of specialist and a hospital, but at all times in all insurance networks. But because we've had a couple hospital systems buy up the hospitals, it means that when you go to a hospital in Santa Cruz, California, you got to have the hospital say yes to you, or you can't offer insurance in that county. And so it means that there's no leverage that the insurance company has. And so California could redefine the time and distance rules so that you could use telemedicine or provide transportation to get to further away providers, and that would do a lot to lower premiums and lower prices and make the market more competitive. So that's one thing that I would add to the list. And I'd add things on medical malpractice. So states actually govern medical malpractice. And so when I was in the federal government, I tried to change medical malpractice rules, but actually the lawyers all tell you, you're preempting state law. States have control. And so California could definitely do things around. One of my favorite ideas is give doctors safe harbors if they document that they're following clinical evidence and they use decision support. Because one of the hard things to get doctors to do is actually go, consult Google to make sure they're doing it the right way. And if you gave them protections, if they demonstrated that they actually did do that check for your safety, that would be, a really important innovation. And likely in the early experiments on that would save money by creating safer care. And so I would encourage him to do some medical practice reform, too, to quench the doctor's sort of desire to have this happen.
Sounds like a pretty good list, and good thing we're recording it, so we'll make sure the gubernatorial candidates hear it. On another more specific and newsworthy topic that's out across, not just in California, obviously, but across the country on the opioid crisis. It's not just a medical care issue, but what's your view about what we should be doing there?
Well, first, I remember in medical school and residency, we were taught that pain is called the fifth vital sign. Then it was in every exam room, we had the scale with the happy to frowny faces. And we'd say, where are you today? And we were then told that if we prescribed an opioid for acute pain, that it wouldn't be addictive. And so we did that. Then it was added by Medicare as one of the quality measures for hospitals that they're actually used when Medicare has a program called STARS, where hospitals get graded 1 to 5 stars. And if you were a patient in a hospital, there's a chance that you got a paper survey where you had to fill out, how we did. And one of the questions was, did the doctor ask you about your pain, and then did the doctor treat your pain effectively? So we were all taught, oh my God, make sure you send them home with a bag of opioids, because that's really effective pain medicine, because we want you to fill out the question the right way. And it is infuriating to find out that lobbying from the drug companies went into getting that question put on the survey that made me prescribe medicines to you that I was told weren't addictive that were. This fifth vital sign thing is absolute bull. And it's incredibly infuriating that we were lied to and taught to do this to patients. And I think about all the patients that I prescribe opioids to who became addicted. And once they're addicted, we then don't cover the addiction treatment programs. Remember, before the ACA, we didn't have mental health parity. So there was no coverage. So I can get you addicted in 1 second, and then I can't help you. The medicine bupropion, which is quite effective for opioid withdrawal, is often either not covered in the formulary by insurance companies, or the steps to get it to you are so cumbersome that, like, I'm heroic to get you to actually get the medicine, because the prior authorizations required are ridiculous. And it's unbelievable to me that I can prescribe narcotics with no prior authorization right now to any of you. And if I write a prescription for the treatment for them, I have to, like, fill out forms and wait 2 weeks and like maybe have it be denied. And so there's a whole bunch to change here. Behavioral health is central. We have to fund it and pay for it and allow people to have access to it. We need to pay for non-opioid pain management. So right now, acupuncture is often not covered. It is effective for many people's pain. Behavioral health care is often not properly covered, and it's helpful too. Injections of medicines that are safe are often difficult to obtain for patients and helpful. There's lots of topical treatments that are helpful that have prior authorization. And so we have things to do. Like most patients' pain can be very effectively treated without opioids. It's a last resort, and they can be helpful. There's a role for them. But all of that's harder than like prescribing an opioid. And so we have an opioid crisis, and it is crazy that we haven't sort of gotten our heads around that all these other things are worth doing, and it's much safer in the long term. And we're spending now so much money on the opioid crisis, I think we're going to get to the point where we'll now pay for the other things. But it's so self-inflicted and so terrible and frustrating. And you read the articles about like McKesson, you know, wow, this small town in West Virginia just dispensed 400 million medicine, you know, 900 opioids per person in the city. And you're like you have computers, like they count. Like how do you look the other way? And so I'm glad that thank God for Dr. Vivek Murphy, the Surgeon General, at shining light on this issue. And thank God the current administration is shining light on this issue. We can solve this problem, and we have to. It's you know, it shouldn't be the third leading cause of death in West Virginia.
Okay. You'd mentioned acupuncture and that. Are there other alternative treatment protocols that we're going to have evidence for that will work and can be reimbursed in the right way, or are they all going to be outside the systems?
No, there's plenty of evidence that says acupuncture and behavioral health and coordinated care works for pain disorders. And they're reimbursed by many insurance companies. If they're not covered, it's a willful choice by a payer, not an evidence-based decision.
Okay. We're getting close to the end of the time, and there's a couple questions here that I want to end with, but I wanted to ask you about, you know, this can be a very complicated topic and one that gets so intertwined that you feel like there's no way out of it. But you were in the middle of the largest reform of healthcare system payment delivery coverage in the United States since Medicare. What you look at it now, what do you look back and say, what's your reflections on what that was like and where we are today?
Well, first, it was a privilege. So I'm thankful for the opportunity to get to work on the problem. And each day was, you know, reminded of the patients that I took care of and just trying to make the system that worked better that also didn't cause harm. Because when you make policy, you're always worried about, like, what are the things I haven't thought of that could happen? And I thought when we passed the law that we'd every year get a chance to, like, make it better. And I'm disappointed that we haven't done the technical corrections that there's never been a legislative piece of, you know, never been a piece of legislation written that was perfect at the beginning. They've all benefited from corrections that have been done. And normally that's not a controversial process. And the ACA is the only one where we ever sort of said we wrote it once and it was like Moses and like we can never change it. And we made a lot of typos in the thing. And so I look back and I say, you know, thank God that we did this. We now are having a discussion in the country about like coverage. Like when we passed the ACA, 50 million Americans didn't have access to insurance. Today, like, we're 95% insured. Like, there's now at least an accepted belief by Americans that access to healthcare is a part of being a citizen in this country, and that wasn't actually true before. So I'm thankful that we've, I think, moved the ball there. There is unquestionably a healthcare system that is, for many reasons, trying to change more quickly to be better, and a whole bunch of payment models that didn't exist before 2010 that are being implemented today that are working. And doctors who are not, I've not yet met a doctor who wanted to get rid of their EHR or go back to fee-for-service, okay? So that wouldn't have happened without the ACA. And so I look over the 9 years and say, well, we cover more people than we ever have before in America. Healthcare costs grow more slowly over this period than they ever have before. And things like readmissions and preventative care improve more rapidly than they ever have before. And doctors are now predominantly on new payment systems. So I view it as a giant success. There are a lifetime worth of more things to do to make healthcare better. It's too expensive. The quality is still erratic. There's a lot we can do with the computers that we haven't done yet. There's a whole lot. This hour like surfaced a bunch of it. There's a lot to do better. But oh my gosh, it's changing in ways that it never would have otherwise, and it's better than it was before. The other great thing is that everybody in healthcare is now concerned about getting better and willing to try new things. So if you're a startup, you can walk into United Healthcare or Aetna or Stanford or Blue Shield, and they'll take a meeting and pilot your product. 10 years ago, they were like, "We got it. We're good. We don't need to innovation." Now maybe they don't like their business models, so they want to get to another one. I'm not sure, but you're seeing uptake of ideas and a spirit to try things that didn't exist before. And a whole generation of doctors and nurses and psychologists and pharmacists and things that are now entering the field with expectations for healthcare being a population health coordinated, consumer-centric, data-rich thing that works on a phone. And that, again, I don't think would have happened without the mixture of the Recovery Act and the ACA and now MACRA. And so I think we made a big difference. It's incredibly frustrating that the country can't sort of move past the rhetoric and litmus test thing of Obamacare to actually talk about what's in it. But when we pulled all the parts in it, people actually always liked them, which is why you have this sort of schizophrenic response to we hate it, but we don't take it away. You know, it's like Medicare. We don't want to take it away.
That's great. Right. Well, we have one last very specific question that I always like to end on someone asking a very practical question. What advice would you give a 26-year-old UCLA graduate thinking of taking out $180,000 in student loans to go to the University of Pennsylvania for a master's in nursing?
I would say congratulations to you. We need more nurses, and there's nothing more rewarding than helping people when they're sick, experience empathy and care, and you will have a rewarding life, so you should do it.
Excellent. Well, thank you. Thank you, Bob, for spending our evening with us.
Thank you.
I am Bill Grant, co-chair of the Health and Medicine Member-Led Forum. We thank Bob Kotcher and Lenny Mendoza for their comments here today. We also thank our audiences here as well as those listening to the recording. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating more than 115 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.
Thanks.
That was great.
I told you to go by that.